Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. If you enjoy our podcasts, please tell your colleagues and subscribe on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy.
Hi, Damien Rowland here, back for the third of these COVID catch-ups. From a communication front, I was thinking about how we best communicate when we're in full aerosol-generating procedure PPE, that is, that you're very likely to have a complete face mask on, you may well have a visor, you may also, depending on where you work, have some form of respirator device, which may well be making a bit of noise itself. And if you have a number of people in the same room, all in similar equipment, hearing, speaking to each other is really challenging at the best of times. And if you're having to do a resuscitation, for example, where you're needing a number of commands to not only be spoken out, but also be acknowledged, it just become really challenging. Speaking to a pre-hospital care colleague, they were saying that actually they're quite used at the roadside to always be speaking in a loud voice. And in fact, some of the niceties of communication can go out the window in those situations, but people just accept that because that's the way it needs to be. Others have suggested we need more written communication using whiteboards to signal intent. But all of these things are going to be very new, especially to child health practitioners. And especially in cases where there are going to need to be also sensitive discussions, I think it is inherent on teams to start thinking about the way that they are managing communication in these stressful situations using kit which impairs communication. I don't really have any direct answers for this, but I'll be certainly looking through the literature and social media to see if we can find some top tips to share in the future. In terms of organisation, there's clearly been a lot of debate, quite a lot of anguish actually, about the availability of personal protective equipment. One of the important things that I think that is necessary for organisations, departments, is to think about not having mixed messages, because you may actually create the very problem that you are trying to solve. If you have a difference of opinion about what PPE is required, you lead to a situation where some people will be using PPE that isn't necessary, and then they use up that particular form of PPE that you're trying to save. We've got a particular issue in the UK at the moment where the National Public Health England guidance suggests that you don't need aerosol-generating protective PPE for doing chest compressions, whereas our current resus council guidelines suggest you do. And it's that type of difference that does cause confusion for staff and causes a lot of fear and anxiety. Now, I'm aware that the resus council are working with Public Health England to try and resolve this difference so that we have one clear message for all staff. But I think those mixed messages are important to resolve as quickly as possible. On the vital signs front, there isn't really much new information about the severity of COVID-19 in children. We continue to have reports saying that they are less severely infected and less severely affected, including those children who have underlying conditions. It's worth having a quick listen to my discussion with Alistair Munro on last week's Children's Emergency Medicine webinar hosted by Don't Forget the Bubbles. One of the consequences of this low impact of the disease has been for there to be an overall drop in presentations to emergency departments for both adults and children, but specifically for children, but also because they are isolated. And there's been a number of reports in the last week, unfortunately, of children coming to harm because there's been a perceived delay in seeking treatment. Now, none of these reports are substantiated. And I think we have to be really careful in spreading concern about something which has clear face validity. I mean, it does make sense that if parents have been told to stay indoors, that they will wait that bit longer with someone they previously would have brought in, and that might cause harm to children. And there are also concerns that medical professionals are also dismissing some symptoms and signs because it's clearly COVID, when in fact it is something else. And there's a number of people beginning to work perhaps on some surveillance studies to make sure that we understand this problem, we can define it, we know what the underlying issues truly are, so we can come up with some solutions. But already organisations such as the RCPCH, and there's a website called Healthier Together, run by paediatricians in Wessex, which have been providing some really good safety netting resources to parents, and it probably is worth everyone having a quick look at those. In terms of investigations and interventions, there really isn't much to add from literature published in the last week. However, on a slightly unrelated but possibly relevant note, there is an interesting paper published in archives this week from the Predict Group. They'd originally done the Paris study, which was looking at whether high-flow humidified oxygen had a benefit in children with bronchiolitis. And what they'd done is they compared just oxygen or traditional therapies with high flow as a rescue therapy. And in this economics evaluation, they determined that actually high flow didn't add any additional benefits. Now, that's not saying that high flow isn't beneficial. What it's saying is if you take a group of children and you randomize some of them to early high flow humidified oxygen, actually, you're not really going to come up with any cost savings. In fact, you are going to spend more money with that approach. So again, I think that the advice stays the same, that if you can treat a child with simple oxygen delivery mechanisms, then you should do that before reaching for your high-flow humidified oxygen device. And finally, dilemmas. So I mentioned earlier about the resuscitation guidance for those with aerosol-generating procedure PPE and how that is causing a bit of concern. The real issue in pediatrics is that most arrests are going to be respiratory in origin, and current Public Health England guidance, so this only really applies to the UK, is that if a child were to collapse in front of you, that you would provide some oxygen, and then not until someone was in aerosol generating procedure protective PPE would you start bagging and masking that child, but you could start chest compressions. Now, I think a lot of people will be uncomfortable with that, one, because it's just really difficult not to intervene directly, but I think that is something that we're all going to have to learn to do, to take that step back. Have a process in your department where you can be rapidly enabling people to be in the correct PPE so that you're ready for these type of events. But also, should you be really giving chest compressions before bag and mask ventilation? Is that really going to provide any meaningful benefit to the child at all, unless they have oxygen in their lungs? And I think this is what a lot of us are kind of pondering at the moment, and looking at the systems to make sure that we're limiting the amount of time there possibly is before you start delivering bag and mask ventilation. And it'd be really interesting to hear people's thoughts and ideas and processes for dealing with that. Thanks again for your time. This is, again, just a few ideas that have run across my desk and my head in the last week, really hoping to open up the discussion so that we get questions and debates in the future. Keep well.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. Remember, you can subscribe to our feed on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you for listening.